From WBUR in Boston, I'm Shira Springer, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game.
We will be a shining beacon of the power of sports to be transformational for communities.
The IOC has a 19th century business model that they are imposing on 21st century cities like Boston.
Olympic bids are complicated and costly when everything goes right. But what happens when everything goes wrong? Ahead on Only a Game, the perils of putting together an Olympic bid. Also ahead, how Dallas Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle has been spending his summer, an American sumo wrestler plays against type, and why English dogs and their owners love Sunningdale Golf Club, site of this week's Senior British Open. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Shira Springer. Bill Littlefield is off this week. In the NBA's summer leagues, rookies and other young players try to show off their skills. This year, there were three leagues, one in Orlando, another in Utah, but the biggest by far was in Las Vegas with 24 teams. Summer league stats usually fade from memory quickly, but Becky Hammon's debut as the NBA's first female summer league head coach made history. Joining us to talk about that achievement and other NBA offseason news is Dallas Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle. Rick, welcome to Only a Game.
Sure, how are you?
Great, thanks. Rick, before we get to Becky Hammon and the Las Vegas Summer League, I want to ask you about the big story of the offseason so far, one that involves the Mavericks. The LA Clippers center DeAndre Jordan agreed to sign with Dallas, but before he put pen to paper, he backed out and returned to the Clippers. What was your view of that situation?
It was a difficult thing for us because it was a signing that would have really changed our present and future. The interim period, you know, that passed, a lot of other free agents came off the board, so it was tough. We had some bad luck with it. When someone changes their mind, you hope they're doing it for the right reasons. You hope that they're forthright and honest about it. And then we got to move forward, which we have, and we recovered well. We picked up a couple other very good free agents and made a couple of trades. And so, you know, we're moving forward.
Okay, let's turn to Becky Hammon. She's an assistant coach for San Antonio. Assistants usually coach summer league teams, and the Spurs made Hammon the first female summer league head coach in history. And she made the most of it, guiding her squad to the league title. You were in Vegas. Were you impressed with her work on the sideline?
Oh, yeah, very much. You know, when she got the position last fall, you know, there was a lot of attention given to it. I really admire the sort of class and dignity with which she handled the entire thing. You know, for me, I've got an 11-year-old daughter who's going to have big dreams. I want her to be able to see people like Becky Hammon. And I don't think we should overlook Nancy Lieberman. She was the first woman to coach a professional men's team in any sport. She coached the Texas Legends D-League team 4 years ago and coached them to a playoff berth. I do think it's very important, you know, as an NBA head coach, to be open to the possibility that you could learn a lot of things from a lot of different kinds of people.
Now, the Las Vegas Summer League also saw the introduction of hustle stats this year. Teams, broadcasters, reporters, and fans could see which players hustled the most in any given game. But whatever happened to intangibles?
Well, I'm not sure hustle stats aren't intangibles in a certain way. I mean, we don't call them really hustle stats. We call them more hard play stats. In this day and age, with the collective bargaining agreement the way it is, you know, a lot of times the talent is going to be relatively equal. Well, what's going to get them over the top? Well, a good coach can get them over the top a little bit, but a team that plays harder than the rest of the teams is going to have a great chance to get an edge. In a lot of ways, it's a really cool thing because the more competitive it gets, the better it brings out of everybody.
When you played in the NBA, what would your hustle stats or your hard play stats have looked like?
My hard play stats would have looked good. My plus-minus stats probably would have looked lousy because I wasn't a very good player. Of course, unless I was on the floor with Larry Bird and Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish, and Dennis Johnson, and then I probably would have had a chance to have a pretty good number for that game.
Final question here. I'm not sure if you like movies, but if you had to pick one to see, Mavericks owner Mark Cuban as U.S. president in the new Sharknado 3, or Mavericks franchise player Dirk Nowitzki in his biographical movie The Perfect Shot, which one would it be?
Well, I've already seen The Perfect Shot. I actually was with a small group that traveled over on our team plane last year to Cologne, Germany, to see the opening, and it is fantastic. The Sharknado thing, I don't know much about that. I've heard a little bit about it. But if I know my owner, you know, that'll be entertaining too.
Rick Carlisle is the coach of the Dallas Mavericks and president of the NBA's Coaches Association. Rick, thank you for joining me.
Sure, my pleasure.
It's time now for Three Stories You Should Know, our weekly roundtable of the sports issues you might have missed. Joining me is Toronto Star sports columnist Bruce Arthur. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, Shira.
And sports writer Eric Malinowski. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Shira.
Eric, we're going to start with you. What do you have for us this week?
All right. Well, during his 22-year Major League Baseball career, Barry Bonds slugged more home runs than anybody else, but he also collected more walks than anybody else, 2,558. However, it may have been the walk he collected this week that may be his most satisfying yet. Back in April, it was a panel of 11 judges from the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals voted to overturn his conviction in 2011 on a charge of obstruction of justice. This was, of course, related to some grand jury testimony that he gave all the way back in 2003 about the federal Balco investigation into the use of performance-enhancing drugs. And the Department of Justice released a statement this week saying that they would not, in fact, be appealing that ruling. So the saga of Barry Bonds, convicted criminal, has formally come to a close. It's pretty easy to make the argument that, you know, this was a poor use of public funds. And I suppose, frankly, I would be surprised to see the government repeat this kind of investigation with such a fervor in the future.
Bruce, what do you think of that?
This is a fascinating case, partly because this is the closest we ever came to seeing an athlete go to jail for lying about steroids, especially someone this high profile. And the real hero is probably Greg Anderson, Bonds' trainer, who did time in prison more than once and never turned on his employer. I mean, if Greg Anderson had testified, this might have been over a long time ago. This kind of ends the Barry Bonds saga on this side of the coin. Now there's the question of his reintroduction into baseball society. He deserves something, but I think it's still a long way before Barry Bonds is accepted in baseball outside of San Francisco.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, and I still don't think this improves his odds of reaching the Hall of Fame in any way, shape, or form, though I'm impressed that you used Greg Anderson and hero in the same sentence. That might be a first. It's my turn now, and I'm going to turn to college football. Earlier this week, the University of Alabama, Birmingham announced that it was reinstating its football program. This news comes 6 months after financial concerns led UAB to drop its football program. And that, of course, prompted a loud outcry, calls to fire school president Ray Watts, and a free UAB movement. Now, I understand this is Alabama and college football is sacred. But I'm quite disappointed by the news that football is back at UAB. Not because I have anything against UAB football, but I really hoped that the university would be a trendsetter and start a serious conversation among smaller college football programs around the country about whether fielding football programs made sense. So, Bruce, what do you think about UAB football getting back in the game? Do we Americans have our priorities all out of whack?
Well, I mean, I think there's a pretty obvious answer to that question. UAB is just one minor symptom here. But what this is, this is an amazing thing. This is people deciding they're going to pay for their football just to keep it alive in this mid-level football program that outside of Alabama, no one ever really pays attention to. Nothing that has come across football's desk and the brain trauma and the painkiller addiction, and you can go up and down the list in terms of what's really hurt football image-wise, you'd think, has dissuaded Americans and, frankly, I'm going to be honest, Canadians from loving football. And so UAB, it would be nice to think that they would be leading some kind of charge, but their fans wouldn't let them. That's the power of football.
I got some serious flashbacks back when I first heard that UAB was cutting the program. I entered Boston University. I'm going to age myself here in the fall of 1998. Which was the first season in 91 years that there was no football at BU because they argued that the operating cost of $3 million a year was not basically worth it. And there were Title IX considerations also, of course. And you know, I always think back, you know, what would my college experience have been like if I'd had college football? And this is a situation that we've seen played out so many times across the country. I think that we're going to continue to see universities do this. And frankly, it's not a bad idea. I mean, you know, universities, when it comes to athletics, are operating more as a business these days than a nonprofit. So these are the sorts of considerations that are going to keep constantly popping up.
So you think there's hope, at least for me, to find another trendsetter in this whole debate, some other college program out there that's going to drop its football program and come to the realization that it's not working for them?
All this has happened before, and all of this will happen again, I'm certain.
Okay, Bruce, what do you have for us?
Well, ESPN, of course, is a leading voice in the American sports landscape. There's almost nothing like it, either in Canada or the United States. It is a monster. It provides nearly 50% of Disney's cash flow. And of late, the biggest stars and the biggest network and power in American sports have started to leave. Bill Simmons, of course, was the biggest name, the man who founded the Grantland writing site, who started 30 for 30, who became the most popular sports columnist in America, which is an amazing sentence. After that, Keith Olbermann. Now, Keith Olbermann is a little less of a surprise. Keith has burned many a bridge in his time, including bridges at ESPN, but this time he didn't. He just maybe cost too much. And now Colin Cowherd, one of the stars of their radio stable, a guy who is a little more controversial than either of the other two, at least in my circles. And he's heading over to Fox Sports, where I think, let's be honest, he's going to fit in just fine. This is an amazing talent drain, because what ESPN is essentially saying is that because they've spent so much money on sporting rights, they are now cutting costs. And the costs they have decided to cut are their biggest stars.
You know, the Simmons one in particular really surprised me, because more than the other people that we've mentioned so far, he was responsible for not just bringing content, for bringing in talent.
And ideas, too.
And ideas, right. I mean, he brought so much more to the network than an Olbermann or a Colin Cowherd ever had. And to see ESPN rationalize that he wasn't worth the expense that they were paying him, that was the most surprising and in the end really disappointing, I think.
Yeah, I'm not buying the ESPN can't afford it argument either. I'm also not buying when ESPN president John Skipper says the departure of Simmons, Olbermann, and Cowherd was just business as usual, please. I think there was also some control issues with ESPN. ESPN, I think, likes to control its talent. And, you know, one of the things that was problematic with Olbermann was that he wanted to do commentary and they didn't want him doing commentary. And Simmons was a very, very vocal critic of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. So I think, you know, they don't like, for lack of a better phrase, the inmates running the asylum.
Well, and with two of these, this circles back to football. Probably. If you believe that this isn't just about money, if you believe that this is also a creative control, and you're right, Shira, that ESPN is fanatical about controlling its talent to a degree. There's lots of churches there, but you can't have too many heretics. Bill Simmons, what was his most controversial thing that he did? He was suspended for calling Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, a liar. Keith Olbermann has been merciless in his criticism of the NFL, along with everybody else, but the NFL has been a really high-profile target. Colin Cowherd's just a jerk. He's a guy who's racist, who's vaguely racist against, now it's Dominicans in baseball. He's done John Wall's father stuff.
That to me is
a much easier transition out, but Simmons and Olbermann are different. This is America's dedication to football.
Well, I guess we'll all have to stay tuned. Our roundtable participants this week have been Bruce Arthur, sports columnist for the Toronto Star. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks, Shira.
And sports writer Eric Malinowski. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Shira.
On January 8th, to the surprise of almost everyone, the United States Olympic Committee named Boston the U.S. bid city for the 2024 Summer Games. The next morning, before a packed house, a who's who of powerful people gathered for a triumphant press conference. Politicians and bid leaders talked about embracing the immense opportunity before the city.
Boston has a vision for a new kind of Olympics, a vision that challenges the norm, encourages creative solutions, that embodies the community spirit that makes the games what they are.
That's Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, and like the rest of the speakers that day, he didn't seem worried about the road ahead. Fast forward to July. Calls for the United States Olympic Committee to pull the bid from Boston grew louder every day. A big International Olympic Committee meeting in Kuala Lumpur looms next week as a critical test. Some say if IOC members give the Boston bid negative reviews, the USOC could decide to spike it. Even if that doesn't happen, veteran Olympics reporter Phil Hirsch of the Chicago Tribune doesn't expect the Boston bid to survive much longer.
The most amazing thing to me is that it's been one misstep after another. They don't ever seem to have gotten the message, and they don't ever seem to have stopped the bleeding.
But wait, isn't Boston a sports town? The Red Sox, Patriots, Celtics, and Bruins often dominate conversation. 500,000 turn out every year to watch the Boston Marathon. Surely the city would be excited to host the games. Think again, says Chris Dempsey of the opposition group No Boston Olympics.
Well, the USOC clearly underestimated the people of Greater Boston. They thought
because we are a rabid sports town, that we would just accept this idea. I think they didn't understand that our passion for sports is rivaled only by our passion for a good, healthy debate.
So I asked Rich Davey, CEO of the local bid committee called Boston 2024, why is selling the Olympics so hard?
Big things are hard. That's what makes them worth it. I think it's hard to get people to focus on a big vision for the city that's 10, 15 years away when, you know, we've got things in front of us today. And we've got to do a better job, too.
Low poll numbers have become the biggest challenge for bid leaders. In the latest statewide survey, only 42% support the Games. But the bid committee likes pointing to nationwide numbers. Here's Steve Pagliuca, who's recently added bid chairman to his titles of Bain Capital Managing Director and Boston Celtics co-owner.
We looked at recent surveys. I think they said 90% of people in America would like the Olympic Games to come back.
89, but 89. That's equivalent, yeah. I guess.
Well, wait a minute. I'm being hyperbolic here. Let me round. 89.2% would like it to be in America.
But 61% said they wouldn't want to have it in their own backyard.
Yes, and again, that is colored, and hopefully that'll change over time. I think the 2020 agenda was a response to that. Those 30%, those 28% that say, gee, not in my backyard, because of the issues that have happened on previous Olympics, with the exception of the United States.
Whenever they can, Boston bid leaders also like mentioning Agenda 2020, a package of IOC reforms designed to rein in costs and encourage the use of temporary and existing venues. Many Londoners probably wish the new guidelines were in place when the 2012 Summer Games ran more than $10 billion over budget. But Davey likes to highlight the positive.
I think my favorite poll of all is when Londoners were asked 1 year after the 2012 Games if Rio was failing so badly, if London should host the Games again, overwhelming support to host the Games again, upwards of 70 to the 80%.
Mayor Walsh would like to see support for a Boston Olympics reach the 70% range. But with poll numbers holding steady at around 40%, the mayor's ambition seems like pure fantasy. So what went wrong in Boston? It seems Boston bid leaders never really stopped to consider that people would question the bid the way they have. Looking back, Boston 2024 architect David Manfredi says he shouldn't have been surprised.
I'm not sure many people expected that Boston would be designated by the USOC. So it went from, that's interesting, to, oh my God, this might actually happen. And we need to know a lot more about this before we willingly come along.
At community meetings, Bostonians lined up to voice their fears. They didn't want a privately funded group of multimillionaires to control the city's future through the Olympics.
So I feel like I've been completely left out. And if I don't get to vote on this, I will remember this during the next local election.
Essentially, what I'd like to know is what will it take to stop this?
Can you expand on why democracy doesn't matter in this context and why you're proud of that?
I can't comment on that now. I'm going to have to take a look at what you're talking about. I'm not familiar with that, to be candid with. Okay, thank you.
Responding to public criticism, the Boston bid went from a walkable venue plan to one with venues spread across the state. Bid leaders also agreed to hold a statewide referendum on the Games in 2016, if the bid survives that long. And earlier this week, a political-style debate about the Boston Olympics was broadcast live on local radio and TV. Sports economist Andrew Zimbalist spoke for the opposition.
Well, in fact, I think most of the numbers that I look at reflect drunken optimism. They don't reflect conservatism.
I couldn't disagree with
that
more.
Let me talk a little bit, Dan.
The joke among reporters who cover the Games is that dictators and authoritarian regimes put on the best Olympics. In 2008 in Beijing, I rarely needed to leave the Olympic Park. Seven venues, including the main stadium, aquatic center, and gymnastics arena, were conveniently clustered together. Unlike Boston, Beijing organizers didn't have to ask permission when planning venue locations and transportation. The same could be said for Sochi. But that was all before Agenda 2020. The IOC says they want a different kind of Games, and Pagliuca thinks Boston's bid, which he sees as fiscally responsible, can show the way.
We will be a shining beacon of kind of the power of sports to be transformational for communities. No great progress is accomplished without some hard work and some fear.
And then there is the tough task of meeting the IOC's demands for financial guarantees, transportation improvements, and facilities. For all its reforms and new guidelines, the IOC remains committed to staging an outsized sports spectacle in a different city every 2 years. Dempsey of No Boston Olympics says it's too much to ask.
The IOC has a 19th century business model that they are imposing on 21st century cities like Boston. They're able to do that because there is still this sense out there that it somehow leaves cities better off.
Boston 2024 still believes its problems can be fixed. Steve Pagliuca is confident new venue locations and greater transparency will change opinions.
As our surveys show, there's about still 40-45% of the people who don't vote yes, but they want to see more information. They're undecided. And when we get in front of those people, we turn most of those into a yes. So I think the polls will take care of themselves. Everyone has a fear of the unknown. So our job is to make the unknown known. And that's what we're doing right now.
Now the Boston Bid's main pitch is, the more you know what we're planning, the more you'll like it. It sounds more like desperation than a catchy slogan. But maybe Phil Hirsch, who's been to 17 Olympics, has an idea to turn the bid around.
Give every citizen of Massachusetts $1 million check. I mean, literally, I mean, I don't see them turning around public opinion.
6.7 million people at $1 million each? Now that's a cost overrun.
The games of the 31st Olympiad are awarded to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
When Rio de Janeiro was voted host of the 2016 Summer Games, Brazilians celebrated as only Brazilians can. In Copenhagen, where the vote took place, soccer icon Pelé and Brazil's President Lula tearfully embraced. In Copacabana, fireworks, confetti, and flags filled the air. Those scenes pulled Brazilian journalist Juliana Barbosa back from working abroad to her home city of Rio. She wanted to see how the 2014 World Cup and the 2016 Olympics would change the city and its people. In her new book, Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, she chronicles that transformation. Juliana, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you could join us. When Rio was named host of next year's Olympics, what did that signify for Brazil and the citizens of Rio?
Well, it was going to be our time in the sun. Brazil was a country that, you know, had been in a military dictatorship until the mid-80s. And in the 1990s, faced huge economic turmoil, hyperinflation. People couldn't plan their lives. And things finally started to change in the 2000s. By the time that Rio was chosen as the host city of the 2016 Games, there was this tremendous optimism, the sense that the country was booming and the world had recognized that Brazil's moment to shine had come.
But between the time when a city wins a bid and a city actually hosts a game, a lot can happen. It's been 6 years since Rio successfully bid for the Summer Games. If the city bid today, how would Brazilians, especially Rio residents, feel?
Well, very, very differently. Two big things have happened since then. One is that economic effervescence that we were experiencing in 2009, 2010 has definitely taken a nosedive. The economy is stagnant. Inflation has reared its ugly head. Brazilians are a lot more ambivalent about big spending. The other thing that happened is that Brazil, you know, first hosted the Pan Am Games back in 2007 and then hosted the World Cup in 2014. The Pan Am Games were more than 8 times over budget. And they left us with venues that couldn't even be reused for the Olympics. So we now have some experience in what it takes to hold these mega international sporting events. We know what the costs are.
And those costs aren't just financial costs. There's an opportunity cost that comes with hosting these mega events, right?
The city's urban planning is taken hostage by these short-term events. And the goals of the World Cup or the goals of the Olympics become the city's goals. Less than 2 months after Rio was awarded the Olympics, the city published a list of 119 low-income communities, which in Rio are known as favelas, that would be demolished. The urgent need that we had for better housing, especially low-income housing, was not going to be addressed and, in fact, was going to be made worse. And in the process, one of the city's most entrenched problems, which is its inequality, was also going to be exacerbated.
Describe the almost unbelievable scene that took place in Rio 2 weeks before the World Cup involving the Brazilian national team and striking teachers.
In the year leading up to the World Cup, Brazilians really poured into the streets in protests that nobody had foreseen. And these protests, one little part of them included this group of teachers that were rallying near the airport, calling, like many people had, for less spending on stadiums and more spending on education. They had signs, they had stickers. And it happened that this protest of teachers cross paths with the bus carrying the Brazilian national soccer team. Now, these men are usually revered as demigods in Brazil. And what happened was these teachers stopped the bus and started rocking them. And the cops that were there raised their batons to the teachers. And you caught these pictures of the players inside the bus, some of them just looking in horror, some of them covering their faces in embarrassment. It was such a signifier of this big transformation in attitude that Brazilians had had.
What do you expect to see from Brazilians in this year before the Olympics?
There's no way of knowing what's going to happen. The president's approval ratings are at a record low, less than 8%. The economy is stagnant. There's a widespread corruption scandal involving the big construction companies. So who knows how Brazilians are going to process and digest all this in this year to come.
Looking ahead to next summer, how do you think the Olympics will be received? What will the atmosphere be like in the iconic Maracanã Stadium for the opening ceremony?
Well, I think that in spite of all this ambivalence, when it comes right down to the party, Brazilians will show up with their colors flying because that's what they do. I think it'll be beautiful. I think the games itself will be beautiful. The real question is, at what cost?
Juliana Barbosa is the author of Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, subtitled Rio de Janeiro on the Brink. Juliana, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk again, but make it beachside in Copacabana with caipirinhas in hand.
I hope so.
Me too. This weekend, 30 miles west of London, the Sunningdale Golf Club is hosting the Senior Open Championship. But when not welcoming top players for prestigious tournaments, Sunningdale goes to the dogs. Seriously. Members can bring man's best friend along for 18 holes. Dogs are free to sprint down fairways, cut across putting lines, and spot balls in the rough. So it's a win-win for everyone. Joining me now is Stephen Toon, the club's secretary at Dog Friendly Sunningdale. Stephen, welcome to Only a Game.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So tell me, how did this all get started?
Well, this started over 100 years ago. The members of Sunningdale were gentlemen farmers who had working dogs. They hunted. And when they came to play golf, they brought the dogs for exercise. And the tradition has continued for over 100 years.
Wow. Tell me then, what's a typical foursome like at Sunningdale with four golfers and four dogs?
To be perfectly honest, sometimes it's four golfers and eight dogs because some members have more than one dog. And I've seen one member bring as many as four dogs to go out with them. Some of the dogs are very well behaved and they all sit quietly on the tee waiting for the ball to be hit. Sometimes they're a little bit excitable and they go hunting in the heather and amongst the trees in the forest, but they eventually come back.
Stephen, tell us your favorite Sunningdale dog story.
My favorite Sunningdale dog story concerns our halfway house, which has a special dog dish on the menu. We serve a dog sausage, which is served on a plate with a napkin, especially for the dogs. And I once had a member call me to say that he'd lost his dog. He had to abandon his golf, and this was a terrible situation. And 2 minutes later, I had a call from the manager of the halfway house who said, I have the member's dog here. He's lost his owner, and he's waiting for his sausage. And so dog and owner were reunited over a sausage.
Do the dogs pay membership dues?
Dogs are free. They have the best deal in the world. They're a member of a very exclusive golf club, and they pay no dues at all. All they have to do is try to find their owner's ball once the ball has been hit into the woods, and many of the dogs are very good at that.
Are some dogs, some breeds, better ball spotters than others?
Yeah. In fact, the working dogs, the gun dogs, the spaniels, the retrievers, and the labradors are very good at spotting the ball and immediately running to where it lands. And then they sit and they wait for the owner to arrive. So they earn their sausages.
Will the dogs be allowed to roam around during this weekend's tournament?
No. To be honest, we wouldn't want any of our guest players competing in the Senior Open. And we wouldn't like to think their chances had been ruined by a dog running alongside them or a dog barking. So we ask that dogs stay at home during our big tournaments.
Now, it seems like dogs on regular golf days would be a bad combination with golf etiquette. I'm wondering, what happens when a dog picks up a ball and runs away with it? Are there ever problems with dogs?
It happens. But our members are very tolerant of dogs, and they're very forgiving of dogs.
Are golfers required to clean up after their dogs?
They are indeed. And equally, we look after dogs. We have dog bowls by the water fountains. When the owner takes a drink, the dog also can take a drink, and we make sure they keep hydrated.
Now, are other pets welcome?
I am not aware that members have any other pets other than dogs. They're exclusively dog people, the members here.
Do you have a dog that you golf with?
Personally, I don't, because I don't have time to play very much golf. Far too busy looking after the members and their dogs.
Stephen Toon is secretary for dog-friendly Sunningdale Golf Club in Sunningdale, England. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
It's been a pleasure. Cheerio for now.
Coming up on Only a Game, grab your helmets, pads, and headset. It's time for virtual football training. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Shira. Welcome aboard.
Thank you. I can't resist starting this week's conversation with FIFA President Sepp Blatter.
Where is my security? Come on.
That's Blatter responding to a comedian who showered him with fake money at a press conference in Switzerland. He sounds a bit like a very wealthy man calling for his butler, doesn't he?
He does. He also sounds like Dr. Evil. And I would like to say on behalf of the comedian that these are very authentic-looking dollar bills, and he should be expecting a visit from the Secret Service any day now. This is the greatest prank of all time. I want this photo, like a wall-sized poster of this photo of Sepp Blatter sitting there with a completely vacant look on his face and all these dollar bills floating around his head.
Now, the press conference did continue, but only after Blatter made this announcement.
We have to clean here first. Otherwise, I will not be able to speak to you, ladies and gentlemen, when we speak about football.
Now, do you agree with Blatter that it is impossible to talk about football when there's a bunch of money lying around?
I have no idea. I guess he meant cleaning up the desk and the floor around where he was sitting and not FIFA, which is what we really have to clean up before we talk about football.
You admitted earlier this week that the CONCACAF Gold Cup had eluded you for most of your career. As soon as you left, victory eluded the U.S. men's national team. After their lopsided win over Cuba in the quarters, were you surprised to see the U.S. miss the final of the Gold Cup for the first time since 2003?
Not as surprised as the organizers were, I'll guarantee you that. I know, this was kind of neat. CONCACAF is just a mess. I mean, if you think FIFA's a mess, CONCACAF is like the triple A ball of international messes. There have been terrible calls. There have been terrible penalties. You know, a Jamaica-Mexico final is certainly exotic, and I think plenty of good seats are probably still available.
After the U.S.'s poor performance, they're calling for head coach Jurgen Klinsmann to be fired. Where do you stand?
No, why? I mean, let him keep the job through the World Cup anyway.
The Houston Astros have acquired pitcher Scott Kazmir from the Oakland A's. Is that a good sign that the team is gearing up for a World Series run?
Yeah, that's exactly what. And, of course, Kazmir's had an incredible, up-and-down career. I mean, 3 years ago, he was pitching independent ball in Texas. Now he went to the Indians and finally wound up signing with Oakland, and now he's back in Houston, and he'll be enormously useful. And it does appear that the Astros are going for it this year.
Los Angeles Dodgers pitcher Clayton Kershaw has extended his scoreless inning streak to 29, but I want to talk to you about the real Kershaw news of the week. Did you know his great-uncle discovered Pluto?
Yes, and Clayton Kershaw, admirably loyal to his family, is insisting that Pluto is a planet, which is actually the correct thing, and not a trans-Neptunian dwarf planet, as many planetary snobs, including Neil deGrasse Tyson, believe it to be. I just think it's terrific. It should be one of those ancestry shows that they do on public broadcasting where they find out the connection between Clayton Kershaw and Clyde Tombaugh, whose ashes, by the way, were on the probe that went to Pluto, which I think is one of the neatest things.
Dallas Cowboys quarterback Tony Romo is suing the NFL for shutting down his planned fantasy football convention in Las Vegas. Does he have a case?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, apparently the ostensible casus belli is that it was going to be at a casino, and the NFL would not like to have its quarterbacks running things at casinos, but it's the NFL just being the NFL and being terrified of its brand.
The NBA is considering changes to its playoff system. Under the new rules, winning the division would not be enough to qualify a team for the playoffs. They'd have to finish in the top eight of their conference. But wait, how often does the division winner not finish in the top eight?
Well, I mean, if you're listening to Commissioner Adam Silver, it's never happened that a division winner didn't finish in the top eight. And apparently his numbers crunchers say that there's a less than 5% chance that it will happen, which of course means it will happen next year.
Exactly. Thursday at the Canadian Open, PGA Tour veteran Robert Allenby fired his caddy on the 13th hole. How would you like to have been the fan who was asked to carry his bag from there?
This is the fourth caddy who's walked off on Robert Allenby. I get the feeling the problem may be Allenby and not the caddies.
Triple Crown winner American Pharoah joined Kim Kardashian as a model in Vogue magazine this week. I wonder who they got to do the wardrobe fitting.
I don't know, but I know that American Pharoah has worked a lot harder in the past year than Kim Kardashian has.
Some critics have suggested the horse was photoshopped to look less muscular. This is really taking the thin model thing too far.
Yeah, I think that people have too much time on their hands.
For the first time, men will be competing in synchronized swimming at an internationally sanctioned competition. Is this a step forward for gender equality?
It's a step forward for gender equality, and I'm happy to acknowledge that it's a step forward for gender equality, and I'm also happy to acknowledge that I will not be watching a minute of it. Although it does remind me of the great Saturday Night Live skit with Martin Short and Harry Shearer as the two American synchronized swimmers. And if you'll recall, Martin Short was wearing a bathing cap and a nose plug.
Well, I believe the male swimmers, synchronized swimmers are wearing nose clips as well. For me, a close second for video of the week after Blatter was pro surfer Mick Fanning's epic throwdown with a shark off the coast of South Africa. And for a change, man beat shark. What are the chances this was just an elaborate marketing ploy for Sharknado?
Oh, I think this is Mick Fanning is a genuinely scared person in this video, even though he did manage to fight off the large fish. My favorite reaction, of course, came from the three geniuses at the morning Fox and Friends show who were speculating as to why it's impossible to keep sharks out of surfing competitions without apparently they're not aware that sharks, you know, live in the ocean and stuff. But this is the greatest surfing video of all time. And let's not leave the story without giving a shout out to Mick Fanning's incredibly cool hometown, Tweed Heads, Australia.
Love it. What do you think of the Indiana Pacers' new old uniforms?
Yeah, they're going to wear a Hickory High jersey to celebrate the 30th anniversary of that now iconic American film, which will be good because it will be the first time that any black people ever wore Hickory High uniforms.
And finally, Charlie, the Fresno Grizzlies have a new name, and I think I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, the Fresno Tacos. Last year they had Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle jerseys. Now they're doing this taco thing, and I will not tell you what I think the taco looks like. But once again, the minor leagues are the only place where anybody has any fun in baseball.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins Bill Littlefield each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Rook.
Maybe I'd be in the NFL if this was available.
That's former Stanford kicker Derek Belch, and he's talking about new technology that's bringing virtual reality to the NFL and some top college football programs. Belch, who graduated from Stanford in 2008, is the founder of Striver Labs. The Silicon Valley startup will be working with the Dallas Cowboys, New England Patriots, and San Francisco 49ers when training camp opens next week, helping quarterbacks and other players prepare for game day. I spoke to Belch last week and asked him to describe what it's like when you put on the virtual reality headset.
You literally have the eyes of the quarterback as if you were on the field. It looks, it sounds, it feels real. I mean, about the only thing you're not doing is getting hit and maybe not smelling the grass, and maybe one day we'll get there.
To be clear, this technology is about watching film in a virtual environment. You're not actually throwing footballs to virtual players or anything like that. So how does it help individual and team performance on the field?
This is not all about throwing for 500 yards in a game or throwing 5 touchdowns and 0 interceptions. It's about getting everybody on the same page, and particularly at the NFL level, there's a lot on a quarterback's plate, and especially for young players, it's feast or famine, and they throw you in the big kid pool right away, and we're just accelerating the learning process for these guys so they don't have to think as much on the field. You know, there's a lot of guys that can throw the ball, but the thinking thing is what separates the average from the good and the good from the great.
I've actually had the opportunity to put the headset on and immerse myself in a Stanford football practice. I learned one thing. I would make a very, very poor quarterback at Stanford.
There you go.
Put that out there. Please don't recruit me. But what evidence do you have that time spent virtually immersed in practice helps players perform better during games?
We actually did a small study last year at Stanford. We put 3 of our quarterbacks, the senior, the junior and the freshman, into the virtual environment. We had them watch a series of plays. We tested their reaction time. We tested their recall. We tested their memory over the course of the session. And then we brought them back in again a month later, and we did the whole thing again. The results were about what you would expect. Reaction time went down. Recognition, recall went up.
Starting Stanford quarterback Kevin Hogan began using the headset before games late last season, and his completion percentage improved from 64% to 76%. Coincidence?
There's been a lot of press out there that has basically attributed Kevin's great play down the stretch to our training device. I will never go that far. You know, there are other things going on there. And, you know, Kevin, he's a good football player. And it may not have been because of virtual reality, but the numbers are there. The data's there. We saw that he used it. You know, we heard qualitatively, You know, anything that can make a player feel more prepared is going to have a positive outcome on performance, and I think at the very least that's what we're going to do.
Obviously, there's always going to be a risk of injury during actual games, but is there a chance this technology could help reduce injuries during practice? I mean, instead of getting hit by a teammate or running and throwing too much on a hot summer day, you can get more reps in virtually, right?
I'm a realist on this stuff. I'm not going to sit here and say we're going to just completely eliminate practice injuries. No. The NFL, no one hits each other during the season, right? And the quarterback is untouchable. I mean, God, if anyone goes within a foot of a quarterback, they're practically cut. What we can do is, let's take an example. Let's say a player is already injured and he can't be on the practice field going full go, but he can get his reps in a virtual environment and not further injure himself while he's rehabbing. So when he is ready to go, his mind is there and it's just his body that has to catch up.
So what do you think is the future for virtual reality in sports for both fans and competitors?
You know, 5 years from now, we really could be looking at a situation where you might be able to just watch a game from your couch as if you're right there on the sideline. On the player coach training side, we're only scratching the surface. I think by next year, you're going to see every NFL team with what we do or something similar. We're working on some stuff that can basically trick your brain into thinking you're doing something that you're not, that makes it seem even more real. We're working on some stuff that is going to actually be able to have you move around at a decent pace. I think 3-4 years from now, it's going to be totally different. But I don't think we're ever going to be able to just totally replace practice.
Derek Belch is founder of Striver Labs. To see how virtual reality training works, you can link to a video at our website, onlyagame.org. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you, Shira.
During the first weekend of August, sumo wrestlers will descend upon Long Beach, California for the U.S. Open of Sumo. Reporter Susan Vallett met with a hometown favorite who's breaking stereotypes and trying to find more opponents.
I walk into what looks like a typical martial arts studio here in Southern California. I'm not sure what to expect. I'm told to take off my shoes. The wrestlers are setting out a white mat with a teal circle in the middle of the floor. They're each wearing a mawashi, one of those traditional sumo wrestling belts. Most are wearing bike shorts or boxer briefs underneath, but only one sumo wrestler is wearing a shirt.
My normal life, by day I'm a secretary and by night I am sumo fighter. No.
That's Janelle Hamilton, single mom, grad student, and Girl Scout leader.
So I tell people that I'm a sumo wrestler, and these are people that know me for a long time. And they're like, oh, that's so cute. You know, you think you're a sumo wrestler or whatever, and you know. And then time goes by, maybe a half a year or whatever, and it comes up again. And they'll say to me, I thought you were just kidding. And I'm like, no, I'm hopping on a plane tomorrow to go sumo wrestle, you know, in some other country. I'm not just kidding.
Good job. All right, she won. Janelle got her start in sumo 6 years ago. A coworker who knew Janelle had done kickboxing in high school said,
come try sumo. We need some women.
And so Janelle's co-worker took her to Muscle Beach in Venice.
And they laid down the ring, and I was told, do what they do. And so we put a mawashi around me, and I watched, you know, a couple people go at it in the ring. And so I just did what they did, and I've been hooked ever since.
Janelle's not going all WWE and throwing guys out of the ring today. That's the goal. Push your opponent out of the ring or make him touch the ground with anything but the bottoms of his feet. You don't earn points. You push someone out or down, you win. Period. There's no one here today in Janelle's weight class, but she says what really matters is strength and strategy, not size.
I think it helps maybe get the stigma out of people's minds that you have to be this 300-400-pound person to compete in the sport. We can acquire athletes from all different ranges of weight and athletic abilities.
I've got to admit, as a rec hockey player, I'm a bit jealous of the muscles that define Janelle's shoulders. Looking around, there's a chubby guy, a skinny guy, and everything in between. The practice starts. Janelle's long braid of brown hair flies up as she slams her hands into an opponent's neck, using her gymnast frame to push him out of the ring. Obviously, Janelle's not a stereotypical sumo wrestler.
Everyone has the opportunity to win. just because you're like me, 130 pounds, and you go against a competitor that's 300 plus pounds, you know, three times my body weight, I still have the opportunity to win. So it takes a lot of strength, agility.
I wanted to interview other women who train with Janelle. They pretty much don't exist. She mostly travels to international competitions on her own, meeting teammates from other parts of the country.
For us, our minor leagues, if you would say, is the national competition. We don't have competitions throughout the year like the men get to go to because none of us show up.
I totally would have dropped the gloves. I mean, bowed politely and tried to fight Janelle on that mat. But I'm nursing a fractured wrist and a broken toe, so I decided for the sake of my doctor's bill, probably better not to. Janelle won gold in lightweight and bronze in the women's open weight division at the U.S. Open of Sumo last year. And she's heading to the World Sumo Championships in Japan later this summer. Women's sumo, at least on the amateur level, is growing in Japan. Here in the U.S., Janelle's looking for some competition, and she promises she'll go easy.
Sure, I can just mull you over, but what fun is that if I'm just going to do that all the time? I want to fight, so bring it. And if I have to teach you how to do it, then I'll take the time to do it.
Janelle's bummed sumo didn't make the short list for the upcoming auxiliary games in Tokyo. She says the 2020 Olympics in Japan would have really boosted her sport. But even though I can't take her on right now, you can.
See what competitions are coming up and just sign up to compete. And then you could just be like me and just be told, do what they do. And then you can have a go at it.
For Only a Game, I'm Susan Ballett.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our assistant producer is Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. Our intern is Joe Jacobs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Sunningdale Golf Club Secretary Stephen Toon, who points out that Sunningdale was recently the site of two albatrosses, which in golf terms is one stroke better than eagle.
I think the dogs would chase those albatrosses. They'd never catch one, but they'd love chasing them.
Maybe it would be better for the dogs to work on their putting. I'm Shira Springer. Only a Game will be back next week with more sports NPR style. Thanks for listening.